Testing 1, 2, 3. That sound better? At least to Craig. All right, did everybody hear what I said to start with? All right. We will be starting the book of Job next year, and probably in January, maybe the latter part of January, starting the book of Job, going through it, take us most of next year. But in the meantime, we're going to be doing two or three little different things. And as you probably have picked up on, in between books that we're preaching through, we do a few psalms. And we're going to do that again. We're going to be looking at Psalm 36. We usually do between 5 and 10 psalms in between books. And we start at Psalm 1. We're all the way to 36. This morning, I was looking at the text and studying and reading, I was thinking about just the way our nation is and the way people live in our country. And, you know, when you're a kid, you don't pay a whole lot of attention to how, you know, the interaction between people and the way the adults really think about life and look at life. So maybe it's been this way, you know, for 50 or 60 years, and I just never picked up on it. But it seems to me like that in the world over, and maybe a little different blend of that in the United States, but there is a conflict going on between people. There is, and it's, for the most part, it is that one side blames the other of being either racist or bigots or, you know, whatever other words you want to put on there. And to be honest with you, I don't see that. I know very few people who are really racist. I know very few people, and by racist I mean someone who believes that my particular race is superior to some other particular race in some way. Obviously there are differences between races and characteristics of different races, but that doesn't mean one is better than the other. But I don't hardly know anybody. I'm sure I could go find somebody somewhere that was a racist. But I don't know anyone very close to me at all that I would say that person is a racist. And yet that term is thrown about as if our nation is full of them. And I want to just suggest to you that the problem is not racism. The problem is not bigotry. The problem is a difference in how we view the world. The problem is the difference between someone who looks at the world apart from God and someone who looks at the world believing in God and taking God into account as to how they view the world around them. I think that bottom line, at the root of it, that is the difference. And that, I think that thought is rarely expressed among those who have the ear of the media or of the television cameras or whatever. That idea is, I've never heard it expressed publicly. Here's the problem. Here is the difference between you and me. The song we're looking at today brings that out very vividly. Not only brings it out, but it carries it to its logical conclusion. So keep that in mind as we read the Psalm. Psalm chapter 36, beginning in verse 1. An oracle is within my heart concerning the sinfulness of the wicked. There is no fear of God before his eyes. For in his own eyes he flatters himself too much to detect or hate his sin. The words of his mouth are wicked and deceitful. He has ceased to be wise and to do good. Even on his bed, he plots evil. He commits himself to a sinful course and does not reject what is wrong. Your love, O Lord, reaches to the heavens, your faithfulness to the skies. Your righteousness is like the mighty mountains. Your justice is like the great deep. O Lord, you preserve both man and beast. How priceless is your unfailing love. Both high and low among men find refuge in the shadow of your wings. They feast on the abundance of your house. You give them drink from your river of delights. For with you is the fountain of life, and in your light we see light. Continue your love to those who know you, your righteousness to the upright in heart. May the foot of the proud not come against me, nor the hand of the wicked drive me away. See how the evildoers have fallen, thrown down, not able to rise. We look at the text. There's a couple of scriptures that you can easily compare this psalm to. Psalm 36. The first comparison you can easily make is with Psalm 1. In Psalm 1, the psalmist gives a contrast between the ungodly man and the godly man. He starts out talking about the blessedness of the godly man. Remember the psalm, blessed is the man who walks by the rivers of water, doesn't sit in the seat of the scornful, doesn't stand in the way of sinners, right? But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and his law does he meditate day and night. And he contrasts that with the ungodly. The ungodly are not so, but they're like the chaff which the wind blows away. And then he has a conclusion. The ungodly shall not stand in the day of judgment, nor sinners in the seat of the righteous. All right, so in Psalm 1, he talks about comparing the godly first with the ungodly, and then the conclusion. In this Psalm 36, is just the reverse. He starts with the ungodly, contrasting them or comparing them to the godly, and then gives you a conclusion. The other comparison that you can make is with the last half of Romans chapter 1. And this is really with just the first four verses of Psalm 36, talking about the progression of evil. The progression in a man's thought of the ungodly man, and how his thought patterns and his life progresses down a certain path. So, that's one thing to consider. Now, I've got three points on the outline I want us to look at. The first one, I didn't leave you any blanks, so they're all filled in. First one I'm calling this, the irreversible downward spiral of the wicked. Now I've got some adjectives there, and I've given some thought to these adjectives. Didn't just put them in there just to be adding words. The first adjective is irreversible. What kind of spiral are we talking about? An irreversible spiral. It is a spiral that cannot come back. That's a pretty strong word. Irreversible. And I want to preface, I'm not prefacing, I've already said it, but I want to make this the acknowledgement that God can do what God wants to do. And the wicked can be on a seemingly irreversible spiral, and God can change their life. But as a general rule, this spiral that the wicked person is on is irreversible without a supernatural influence of God. It will not be reversed. It's not just irreversible. I'll use another word, downward. Mankind is not evolving upward. I'm not sure he's evolving at all. if he is, it is a downward path. It's an irreversible downward spiral. A spiral that is getting worse. A path and a life that is not improving. It's a pattern of life that is decreasing in its value, in its worth. Now let's look at the first four verses that point that out. He talks in these verses about flattering. And I want you to help me out here. How would you define the word flatter? What was it?
False esteem.
False esteem.
False praise.
False praise. Picking up on the common thing between their two answers? False, right? Okay. Somebody explain the definition of the word flatter with a little more than two words. I'm going to call names. False attention given to gain. What you said? Okay. That's
making something seem better than it is.
Blowing smoke.
That's a good one.
Let's go back to what Brian said. And I forgot what he said. Attention given. Given to who?
Somebody else.
Somebody else. Okay, usually. It's attention or praise or something given to somebody else. For what reason? Make yourself feel good to gain something for myself. Right? Now or later. Okay. Would we say, if I flatter someone, would you say I was being sincere?
No.
Never? Can I flatter someone and be telling the truth? I mean, y'all use the word false praise, false esteem. Can I flatter someone and yet be telling the truth? Okay, what's the difference between a compliment and flattery? Sincerity level. Okay. So if I tell Kristen, if I say publicly in her presence, she's the best violin player or she's a great violinist, is that a compliment or flattery? Could it be flattery? It could be flattery if I'm trying to butter her up for whatever reason or something, right? Okay, so there's an element of flattery that is for my own benefit that is not present with a compliment. Flattery is usually the exaggeration of a person's qualities or the pointing them out in such a way that it gains something for me. There's something that I have in mind for my own benefit. Okay, now, so that's flattery. This text talks about flattering oneself. Okay, if I flatter myself, it's sort of like, and this is probably a bad illustration of this. It's sort of like I'm two people. This one person who knows the truth about me is trying to convince this other person that I'm really not what I am. That I'm really usually better than I know myself to be. So I flatter myself that things are not what they appear to be. All right? Now that thought is important in our text. It's important in our life. Jonathan Edwards
gave four or five ways in which people, common ways in which people flatter themselves. And I wrote five of them down. He said, men flatter themselves with a secret hope that there is no afterlife. Why would a man want to flatter himself and make himself believe that there is no afterlife? Right, because he doesn't think that if there is an afterlife, it's going to go too well for him, right? So he tries to convince himself. He tries to flatter himself into believing that there is no afterlife. He said another one. They flatter themselves that death is a great way off. Why? Same reason, pretty much. Except a little variety here. I've got time. I've got time to change my ways, right? Third one, men flatter themselves that they should not be damned because they lead moral lives. Now we've heard, I'm sure you've probably heard me say this before, but a person who believes that they are good, that they have kept the law, that they are a good moral person, and that gets them favor before God, usually are doing one of two things. They usually have an exaggerated opinion of their self, a more high opinion of themselves and their own righteousness than they ought to have, or they have lowered the standard. They have pulled down the demands of God's law until, guess what? They can meet it, right? Years ago, I was involved in an evangelistic endeavor at the church we used to go to, and I'd go to, you know, talk to the people, cold turkey evangelism. And we had the kind of the starting point of how you would initiate a conversation, and usually it would go something like this. You know, if you were to die today, do you think you would go to heaven? That'd be one way you would start. Another question, and the one that I typically would use is, you know, do you have confidence that when you died, you'd go to heaven? That if you were to die today, you'd go to heaven. Do you have confidence you'd go to heaven? Their answer is either yes or no, usually. If it's no, then, you know, that's my lead-in to share with them the gospel. If the answer is yes, then I had a follow-up question. And the follow-up question told me a lot. If they said, yes, I have confidence, if I die, I go to heaven, my question would be, on what do you base that assurance? On what do you base that assurance? And their answer to that question will tell you a lot about their theology. And the reason I said that, because it made me think of that on this point right here. We talked to this one guy, and he said, well, I said, I believe that God kind of grades on a curve. And, you know, it's kind of a grading scale, you know, 1 to 10, and, you know, 1 to 5 don't make it, and 6 to 10 make it. Well, already when he was saying that, I had my next question ready, right? What was my question? What's your number? Where are you on the curve? Is it a surprise to anybody that he was a 6? All he needed. He flattered himself that he was above that 5 cutoff mark. Right? Flattered himself. But he showed enough humility not to claim that he was a 10 or a 9. We flatter ourselves that we lead moral lives and therefore we should not be damned. Now, I might be talking to the choir. Maybe not. Look at your own life. Look at your own thought and ask yourself, why is it that I have any thoughts at all that I will go to heaven? Be honest. What is it that gives me any hope in my life that I'm going to heaven? Ask God to strip away the layers of flattery, let you see exactly what you're depending on, what you're trusting in. He goes on, men flatter themselves that they have good intentions. I'm good at that one. I know I fail. I know I screw up. I know I mess up. I know I sin. But my intentions are good. Yeah. The fifth one, they flatter themselves that they have done a great deal toward earning salvation. Now, these first four verses, I want you to, we're going to read through them again, and then I'm going to give you some points here. It's on the outline. Looking at verse 1, an oracle is within my heart. And I think the my heart there's a debate as to if this is the psalmist talking or if this is God's thoughts. I tend to think this is the psalmist giving God's thought. God has an oracle within himself that he is giving to us. He's telling us the way that it is. An oracle is within my heart concerning the sinfulness of the wicked. So here he goes. There is no fear of God before his eyes. So here is a man who doesn't fear God. Doesn't fear God. Should you be afraid of God? Yes. The answer is yes. All right? Forget all this respect stuff. The answer is yes. You have good reason to fear God. Because he is holy, he is just, he is righteous, and you are not. That is good reason to fear God. There is no fear of God before this wicked man's eyes. He is not afraid of God. Would you say that? Would you stand and boldly proclaim, I am not afraid of you, God? No. I know you've heard me use this illustration too. Only have 5 or 6 illustrations. I use them over and over and over. The late 1800s. You raise your hand when you realize you've heard this before, okay? Daniel already knows. Late 1800s. My late 1800s illustration. There's a man named Robert Ingersoll. John McCarty's got his hand up now. An atheistic, supposedly orator, goes around the country in public squares proclaiming that there is no God. And he would stand in the public square with people around. You know, people would come, and that was the thing to do in those days when the orator came to town. Everybody came out to see him, you know, to hear him. Would publicly proclaim in the square, if there is a God in heaven, I'll give him 5 minutes to strike me dead. You know, 5 minutes is a long time to wait. A long time. Can you imagine standing there for five? He would just stand there for 5 minutes waiting. If I'd been God, he wouldn't have had to ask me twice, right? It wouldn't have took 5 minutes. Now, why am I that way? What is the difference between me and God that I would strike him dead and God lets him have his 5 minutes of fame? Huh? Christy, what'd you say? I am insecure, right? I'm insecure enough that I would have to, you know, if I've got the ability, I'd have to respond. God's not insecure. God, it doesn't bother God what people think about it. It doesn't bother God that after the 5 minutes that the people are wondering, well, maybe there isn't a God, or, you know, or whatever. God's not threatened by that. No fear of God before their eyes. That's the beginning of a downward spiral, an irreversible spiral in a man's life. Verse 2, for in his own eyes he flatters himself too much to detect or hate his sin. He flatters himself, he talks himself into believing that he is good, that he is righteous, that he is okay, that he is superior, all of these things, to the point that he cannot hate his sin. He cannot despise what is wrong with him. It might just be his frustration with his wife or kids. But he flatters himself enough that he cannot see his shortcomings, whatever they are. He is a victim. It is always someone else's fault. Let's go on. Verse 3. The words of his mouth are wicked and deceitful. And notice the next phrase. He has ceased to be wise and to do good. He is no longer a wise man. He is no longer able to make wise decisions. Verse 4. Even on his bed, he plots evil. At night, he does the evil that he participates in the daytime is not impulsive things. He has thought about it the night before. On his bed, he plots evil that he will carry out the next day. He commits himself to a sinful course. It is a sinful course that he has flattered himself into believing is not sinful. He does not reject what is wrong. Now I want you to look on the outline now. The wicked replaces God with himself as sovereign over his life. Here's that downward spiral. God is no longer sovereign over my life. I'll take care of myself, thank you. I'm my own God, thank you. There is no God. I'm not afraid of God. I'll take care of me. Whatever I want to do, that's what I'm going to do. You can have your religion for a crutch if you want. I don't need it. They've replaced God as sovereign over their life with themselves. I am my own boss. I am sovereign. But in doing that, he loses his reference point for what is right and wrong. Now, most people who would tell you they don't believe in God have not thought this deeply. They think they're just cool. But when you refuse to acknowledge God, then you lose a reference point for what is right and wrong. An unmovable, unshakable reference point. Because if there is no God, then who decides what is right and what is wrong? You do. And if what you think is right is different than what she thinks is right, then what do you do? Well, for the most part, we just ignore it and go on. You know, we hang out with those people who,
kind of think like us and act like us, and so we don't have to think about it that much. But all the while, this undergirding of your life is being shaken. It's being rattled. It's being torn apart. And there is no answer for you. Because without God, there is no one to tell you what is right and wrong today, tomorrow, forever. So he is unable. He loses his reference point for what is right and wrong. He is unable to hate evil because he's not sure what evil is. Number three, since he can't define evil, he can't define good either. Good implies the existence of that which is not good. Evil presupposes that there is something that is not evil. Thus, his own desires become the driving force of his decision. He lives for today because tomorrow we die. All he can see is the 70 plus years of his life that he will live, and that's the end of it. So I might as well get all the gusto I can get. He becomes blind to what is apparent to those around him. He is unable to know good or to choose good. This person will eventually self-destruct. He will fall. He will be unable to rise again. Look at verse 12 of this chapter. Last verse. See how the evildoers lie fallen, thrown down, and not able to rise. There are millions of people in this spiral today. Millions of them. You'll see them in the gutters. You will see them in boardrooms of big corporations. A downward spiral because inside, in their mind and in their heart, their life is a wreck. There is no hope. They have no hope for the future. Their life has no purpose. You can see them in big cities on the streets. Just look at people. That's the wicked. Second point, verses 5 to 9, he talks about the believer. And notice the difference. The difference is not as much. The difference is the results. The difference is the way their lives look. But the real difference is why. The real difference is here, within their mind, the way they think. Notice in verse 5 what it says about the believer. The believer says this, your love, O God, reaches to the heavens. Notice the difference between that and I'm not afraid of God. Isn't that a huge difference? Your love, O God, reaches to the heavens. Verse 5. Your faithfulness to the skies. Your righteousness is like the mighty mountains. Now, why does he compare God's righteousness to mighty mountains? I've racked my brain over trying to figure out why these analogies, why this comparison. And the only thing I can come up with, the best possible thing, is when you look at a scene and you see mighty mountains in the background, those mountains are there. I'm not going to go around them. I mean, I'm not going to go through them. I might go around them, over them, under them, whatever, but I'm not going to move them. They are there. They are established. Perhaps that's what he says when he says, God, your righteousness is like the mighty mountains. Your justice like the great deep.
the great deep. There is something unknown about the great deep, isn't it? Just those two words, great deep, leave us with some measure of incomprehensible. Something that has not been conquered, something that has not been tamed, something that is a great deal of unknown about it. God's justice is like the great deep. And that is important because our finite minds will not always understand God's justice. There will be times in our lives when we will want to know why. How does this square? How does this fit? We'll see that in the book of Job in the next few months. How does this square up? How do I make sense of the things that are going on in my life? Have it settled in your mind that God's justice is like the great deep. You will never be able to comprehend it all in this life. God's providence. O Lord, you preserve both man and beast. Now notice the next statement on my outline. His understanding, the believer's understanding of how God touches his life affects him. It has an effect upon his life. The way I feel about God, things I know about God, the way I think about God, has an effect on how I live. It has an effect on the decisions that I make. What I know about God compels me to act in certain ways. How does it compel the believer to act? Notice what he says in verse 7. How priceless is your unfailing love. Both high and low among men find refuge in the shadow of your wings. First of all, he finds refuge. There is a place to rest. There is a place to find refuge, and it's under the shadow of his wings. What kind of person would run to the and to hide under the shadow of someone's wings? One in danger, one in need, one who trusts, one who is humble, right? One who recognizes, I can't do it. I have to go here. I need this. How different is that from the wicked? I don't need God. I don't need the shadow. I don't need his wing. I won't hide under his wing, right? But for the believer, we acknowledge our need and our dependence of God. The next thing, we drink our fill. We are satisfied. What does the word sate mean? S-A-T-E. Completely filled. Completely filled. And we get our word satisfied from that root. The root of that word. Completely filled. Satisfied. Does God satisfy you? Does he? Does God satisfy you? Let me ask a different question. Is there anything about God that you would change? If it is, you're not satisfied with God, are you? Are there ways that you wish God was just a little different? God would do things a little different? Are you satisfied?
Are you saturated with him? Crude illustration, perhaps. y'all have heard, I'm sure, we put my mother in the nursing home this past week. And last 4 years she's been living in our place, and her eating habits. You know, you have to kind of trick her into eating, and, you know, just have to kind of find what works to do this and do that. And very seldom would she eat, you know, very much. And one thing that I figured out that seemed to not work was if you gave her a normal-looking plate of food, you know, two or three things with normal size helpings, it was like, oh, that's, you know, who's going to eat all that? Or, you know, what are we going to do with that? It's like it's too much. And so she wouldn't eat any of it. And I found out if I give her just a little bit, you know, just a little bit of this, a little bit of that, she would eat. And some of the times, here's what I would do. I would eat with her, and I'd have the same thing that she's eating. I'd give her just a little bit, and she'd be just about to finish the last bite, or maybe she had finished the last bite, and I'd say, look over there, you know, what is that over there? And while she had her head turned, I'd put another spoonful on her plate. She turns back around, and she's got Alzheimer's. She doesn't know, so she eats that bite, so she ends up eating a little more than she would have if I'd have put it all on her plate. Well, Thanksgiving, and you know, you feel bad sometimes. I mean, I feel bad a lot of times. I go there and give her stuff that's, you know, it's food, it's good food and this thing, but it's not fresh homemade rolls, right? I mean, I didn't have them either, but you know, sometimes you wish that you give her something that really tastes good. And Thanksgiving was 2 weeks ago, and Susan cooked a big meal. Good food. And I loaded up a big plate full. And I carried it over to my mom's. And I sat down and I gave her a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And while she was eating it, I was gobbling down the rest, right? I tried to eat slow enough that I didn't eat it all up, you know, and kept giving her some, you know, to get her head turned. I keep giving her some, And she ate about three times as much as she normally. And I said, is that good? Yeah, that's good. And I said, you know, who made that? And, you know, she didn't understand. And I told her, Susan made this, Susan made that, or whatever. And she ate about three times what she's been eating. And I said, you want some more? Something so simple. Yet I hadn't heard her say it for probably 4 years. No, I'm full. I'm full. And then she belched. Hadn't heard that either.
but I felt good. I felt good that she was full. That's the way we ought to be with God. We ought to be satisfied with Him. Whatever it is God is like, whatever it is God does, I am satisfied with Him. Can that be our life? Can that be your life? Contrast that with the wicked man and his downward spiral of taking care of himself, being his own man, and then the end. In the end, the believer, the godly person, continues to look for God to sustain him. God, keep giving me your grace. Keep showing me your love, verses 10 to 12. Continue what you've done in our life. Continue doing what you've done in my heart. Protect me from this evil man. Let him not overtake me and overthrow me. I'm dependent upon a God who satisfies me. And the day will come when the wicked will fall. The wicked will stumble, and they will be utterly destroyed. They will not be able to rise. What a blessedness it is. What a blessed place it is to be in the day in which we can say, I'm satisfied with God. Let's pray.